Okay. Every year we learn about, the time has come. We're beginning. Every year we learn a little bit about Megillat Esther. Because every year we have Purim. So it's hard to avoid Megillat Esther. It's also true that Megillat Esther is a little hard to put your finger on. I mean, you know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. But it's hard to say that we know what motivates everybody to do what they do. Or what was it that made it turn out as well as it turned out when it was just the day before as bad as you could ever imagine it to be. And also, the characters are not so clear, at least not to me. Well, there's, Mordechai, he's one of the good guys, but he doesn't actually do much. He represents the collective consciousness of the Jewish people. So the Jewish people, sometimes they have to fast and be in mourning. And sometimes they have to dress up in big day malchut. So he's the person who represents that. But he doesn't do much. I mean, you can't say that Mordechai saved the Jews. It was, after all, Esther who saved the Jews. Now, Esther is not a heroic personality like Devorah. Devorah was a general. And Devorah fought a battle, led the Jews into war, and there's no doubt that Barak ben Avinoam, who was the general, the actual general, certainly took second place to Devorah. Esther was not like that. Esther came very close to chickening out, to not accepting the responsibility, even when Mordechai explained to her that it was unlikely that she was the queen of all of Persia for no Jewish reason at all. I mean, she had to come to the conclusion somehow that, she lucked out. She won the Mephala Pais. She was the queen. And that didn't seem to demand much of her because she hadn't been called to see the king in a month. I mean, so she was like one of those assistants to a minister. They put him in a room someplace, and then they kind of don't know that he's there. That was Esther. She became the queen, but she had no function as the queen. So I'm just saying that the characters in the Megillah are not perfectly clear to me. I mean, I know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, but I don't know what's so good about them. And I also don't know why the bad guys are as bad as they are. Now, we like to say that anti-Semitism started with Haman HaRasha. And that, in fact, may be the case. I mean, I'm not sure. But maybe anti-Semitism started with Haman. That is not to say that the Jews didn't have any enemies prior to Haman. They had one, like the major enemy in the tradition, is Amalek. But Amalek was stymied, first by the Jews who left Mitzrayim. You remember Moshe Rabbeinu went up on the hill and held up his hands. Vihi yadav emunah. That somehow the faith of the people of Israel leaving Mitzrayim was strong enough to overcome Amalek. And of course, endless amounts of interpretation and reinterpretation and superinterpretation connected to Amalek exist. And then later on in the time of Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, who was the first king of Israel, he fought with the Amalekites, and he beat them. Of course, he didn't quite do what the prophet Shmuel told him to do, which was to kill them all. He had a little bit of mercy. I mean, sometimes mercy is a bad thing. And he was merciful to the Amalekites, to the king. And so he was eventually forced to give up kingship. He was killed. But his family did not retain the kingship in Israel. So that Haman, after Amalek, right, represents the rejuvenation of Amalek somehow. Amalek is reincarnated through Haman. Now the Megillah, of course, doesn't say that Haman was an Amaleki, but it does say that he was an Agagi. And we know that Agag was at the time of Shaul HaMelech, he was the king of Amalek. And so, Chazal tell us that the reference is almost too obvious. It's almost, you know, of course, Haman ben Hamdata ha'agagi must be an Amaleki. And the advantage to saying that Haman is an Amaleki is that you don't have to figure out why he did it. Because he got it in the gene pool. He inherited it. That's how he was. Before he met a Jew, he knew that when he meets them, he's going to have to do away with them. Yet it's true that Megillat Esther puts it a little bit differently and says that there was in some way a religious battle that took place between Haman and Mordechai. That Haman was charged with being Mishneh LaMelech. He was going to be like the king. And therefore it was important that everybody should bow down to Haman. Mordechai, according to the Megillah, Mordechai did not bow down. Lo kam velo zami menu. He didn't take it too seriously, seeing Haman walking around. Of course, Chazal have difficulty with this, because no halacha demands that I jeopardize myself just not to stand up when Haman goes by. Maybe I don't want to do it. I don't want to give him too much kavod. But there's no prohibition. There's no prohibition against getting up when Haman goes by. So Chazal rewrote the story, or didn't rewrite the story, but maybe the way they understood the story was that Haman was pushing idolatry at that time. And somehow he had this idolatrous icon either hanging on him or in his socks. He sewed it in, the dmut in his clothing. And so when everybody was getting up, they were not just getting up to Haman, but they were getting up to this idolatry. And so that Mordechai was not willing to do, because we know that there are certain circumstances which the halacha calls yehareg v'al yavor. Some things you just can't compromise. And one of them, of course, is Avodah Zarah. One of them is Avodah Zarah. It's not clear why that is the case, but it's very clear that that is the case. That Avodah Zarah does not lend itself to compromise. And you can't say, oh, you know, it's just a little bit of Avodah Zarah. It's just, you know, that Daniel and his friends, in a story that took place either before Megillat Esther or after Megillat Esther. I'm not so good on the chronology here, partially because it doesn't work out so well. But you know, Daniel came to Bavel with the exile of Tzidkiyahu, the last king in Israel. So the kings in Bavel took the youngest and smartest guys, because they could speak Aramaic. They knew Aramaic. You remember the book of Daniel is written largely in Aramaic. they spoke Aramaic, which was a good thing to know if you were in the diplomatic service. So he took these young guys from Eretz Yisrael, and he put them into a special course, which is what in Israel they call a course. And they put them into this special course, which was going to train the next generation of diplomatic wonders for the king of Babel. But, you know, as it is in these things, you had to accept certain social obligations. So from time to time, they would make a party for all these young, enthusiastic characters. And the king would come, and they would do it in Westminster Abbey. Like, where else would you have a party? So they would all be there in Westminster Abbey, and this would be this guy's seat, and that guy, being people who died 2,000 years ago, you know. Here they are, oh, very exciting. And then the king would come and everybody would bow. And so Daniel and his friends found that difficult. Which goes to show, I mean, if there's accuracy here, that even in the time of the exile, the Babylonian exile, right, which is 586 BC, even the time of the Babylonian exile, there was amongst some of the Jews, at least, a consciousness about the problematics of Avodah Zarah. That you just couldn't let yourself get involved with Avodah Zarah. And Daniel, who was, and his friends who were frum, you know, they wouldn't eat the food. And Daniel even davened three times a day. In those days, in Bavel, right when he was in this course for outstanding young diplomats. So this idea that Avodah Zarah is problematic remained, was with the Jews in the Babylonian exile. Like, in the Second Temple, when the Second Temple was destroyed, it seems that there's been a long history of religious friction. First with the Greeks, the Hashmonaim, and then with the Romans, who understood that you had to get rid of Talmud Torah and you had to put up idols even in the Beit HaMikdash. It was this, but at the time that Daniel went into exile, the time that Mordechai was in exile, it's interesting to me that they had this sense that idolatry was going to do them in, and that they couldn't allow pikuach nefesh, to override the prohibition against idolatry. I mean, you could have said idolatry is like eating chazer, just don't do it. But if it's done, like people around you are eating chazer sandwiches, so no, all right, you know, what are you supposed to do? You don't have to do anything. The same thing could have been done with idolatry. People could have said, okay, you know, it's not so terrible, I don't mean it, I don't think anything of it, so why should I put myself in a position of Yehorig Val Yava? But you see that Daniel did that. And he was thrown into this Kivshan Ha'esh, which was what they liked to do in those days. And nothing happened to him. He came out, and his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Right, you remember those names? They became popular names in recent times, I think. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They're accepted now as names. And Daniel also is a name. So Daniel and Mordechai represent the fight or the stand that Am Yisrael took against idolatry. At the same time, in the Megillah, you have Esther, who's acting as the wife of Ahasuerus, which doesn't sound to me like the way you should go. And that also, it's one of the three Isurim for which you should allow Yehoreg Val Yavo. So you see that, like that tension in the Megillah? Here's Mordechai, Lo Kam Velo Zah. He's not going to move. He sits there like a stone when Haman walks by. When it comes to Esther marrying Ahasuerus, well, it's like a good thing to have. She's like, what do you call those spies who are sleeping someplace, and there'll be moles. Yeah, you know, you have the, like, she's, that's Esther. They put her in there, and if something happens, if we need you, we're going to call you. Right? But as long as we don't need you, we're not going to call you. I mean, that's, it's interesting. To me, it's interesting. But I don't understand the personalities. Like, what is it that they're doing exactly? So I say that Daniel was willing to give himself up, as was Mordechai, apparently. But not Esther. Esther was...
Did Esther have to die, though? She wasn't a married Jewish woman.
She wasn't married?
Oh. She was married to Mordechai, maybe some say. Yeah?
Maybe not. So how would you put her? Why would you class?
I think it's right that she had to marry a king like that, but she didn't have to die for it if she wasn't married, right?
Yeah, but I mean, if she went to marry him, she went to marry him, but she was pushed into it by Mordechai. I mean, that's not, you know, something that you would imagine. It's kind of a strange way to save the Jewish people. I mean, there must be some other way. They could have had, like, somebody becoming the Sar HaMashkim and then poisoning Haman. Why is it so, this whole story has these dubious characters in them? Anyway, I'd like to talk a little about Haman. First, we'll talk about the easy part. There's a tradition about Haman which goes as follows. See the first source from the Gemara in Chulin, Haman min haTorah minayin. So the answer is, there's a pasuk in Bereishit in the beginning, Perek Gimel, Hamin haEitz. Hamin haEitz. So where is Haman in the Torah? Huh? Where's Haman in the Torah? Well, if you the letters spell Haman. Hamin ha'etz. Hey, mem nun, that's Haman. That seems a bit, you know, a bit forced. I mean, you find three letters that come out to Haman, so Haman is in the Torah. But it certainly represents a philosophy, I think. To say, Minayin Haman min haTorah, and then to say, here he is, it's the equivalent of saying, as the Ramban says about other things, that this has got to happen. This has got to happen, that the maturing of Am Yisrael into Am Yisrael depends on Haman. That's what it means, Haman min haTorah Minayin. What is the Torah? The Torah is the path in this computer lingo. The path that Am Yisrael would have to go through in order to become Am Yisrael. And so Chazal, as you know, come up with this absolutely remarkable idea that Kiyemu v'Kiblu HaYehudim has something to do with Kabbalat HaTorah. And that if Kabbalat HaTorah at Har Sinai was done with this tremendous awareness of God's control in the world. After all, there were the Ten Makot in Mitzrayim, and then there was Kriyat Yam Suf, and then there's the whole event of Har Sinai, where it's impossible to have been through this process and not to recognize that God has dominion in the world. But of course, the religious question that came up by the time of Mordechai and Esther was that God may have dominion in the world, but does God exercise dominion in the world? Is God concerned day by day, minute by minute, with what's going on in the world? Or is God concerned about the world sometimes? Those are the two possibilities that stood before Am Yisrael in Paras in the days of Mordechai and Esther. Now they knew that God cares at times very much about the created world. And that, you know, when God cares about the created world, that's Matan Torah, that's Yitziat Mitzrayim, that's fraught with miracles. But what about when you don't see the miracles? Kimu v'kiblu, B'nai Yisrael, understanding after Purim that God's concern about the world is real and ongoing, whether we can point to a specific event or not, that's something that they understood at Purim. So when I say Hama min haTorah minayin, what I mean is, how do I know that there had to be a Haman? I mean, Haman is sort of the last of the Amalekites. I mean, you don't hear too much about Amalek after that. You know that the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim, when he asks about in Bereishis, Perek Lamed Zayin, the Alufei Esav, there's a list of the kings that are descendants of Esav. Now, of course, everybody understands Esav, he's not one of our heroes, right? We don't have to know more about Esav than you have to know. What did the Torah tell us? The Alufei Esav. What do we have to know? The kings of Esav. So you know that the Zohar says that this is the most difficult chapter in the Torah because the chapter of Alufei Esav doesn't have a pshat. That's what the Zohar calls difficult. If a parsha has pshat and also Kabbalah, pshat and sod, so that's regular. That's how it is with the Torah. But if the Torah, there's a parsha that only has sod, that's irregular. That makes it the most difficult. It ought to learn the rest of the Torah if you don't know the Kabbalah. Nu, nicha, you'll still get something. You'll go through it. But if in Perek Lamed Zayin in Bereishis, you don't know Kabbalah, you've got nothing. You don't understand what the words mean, because those words are totally unnecessary for us, for our worldview, for understanding of things. How do we have to do that? Maybe we have to know about Esav, Yaakov, that's something. But I have to know about the children of Esav, the grandchildren of Esav, the kings who came from Esav. No, that I don't have to know. So the Rambam says that if you look at the descendants of Esav, you'll find that one of them is named Amalek. And since there's a mitzvah in the Torah to do away with Amalek, it's important to know the lineage. It's like, let's say you meet somebody in the street. Hi, how are you? Who are you? He says, oh, I'm an Amalekite. So you have to kill him. Which is not something that I think anybody here is looking forward to. But before you kill him, you're going to say, listen, maybe you think you're an Amalekite. Could you prove that you're an Amalekite? So he'll say, yeah, my father was this, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, all the descendants. And that's why the Torah tells us all these names, so we can check on this erstwhile Amalekite before we kill him. So there you have it. That's what the Rambam says. So the Rambam, it would seem that there are Amalekites walking around. Now I know that it's true that the Darshanim, say that everybody's Amalek, everybody's an enemy, everybody is a Nazi, everybody is a German. I mean, but okay, I understand. It's a homiletic twist. But if you didn't have a need for the homiletic twist, if you didn't have to do it that way, then it would seem that Amalek is gone. So Haman min haTorah minayim means that Haman was responsible for a lesson which B'nai Yisrael learned that was totally necessary, min haTorah, in order to forge the final form of Am Yisrael. Like, what would Am Yisrael look like? So what they would look like is a people who had faith that God determines what goes on in the world. Now that does not mean, as has been pointed out elsewhere this week on some Google thing that somebody sent me, that doesn't mean that I know what God is doing. It doesn't mean, sadly, that I know why people are killed, individuals, why people are sick and die. What it is that God is doing, the mathematical reformulations of the actions of God in heaven are so complex that it strikes me as quite remarkable that anybody could argue, I know why this happened. Or isn't this a sign that? That, to me, is not good thinking. We do as well as we can. We make the cheshbon as well as we can. But we don't know at all why God does what God does. And you see that the one who tried to figure this out was Abraham Avinu, but he couldn't do it. Abraham Avinu said, if you kill everybody in Sodom, is that just? That's what Abraham Avinu didn't understand. And at the end, he still didn't understand, because God saved the only person who was perhaps worthy of being saved. That was Lot. So here, that's what it says. It says, Haman min ha-Torah minayin, Hamin ha-Eitz. Esther min ha-Torah minayin. Esther min ha-Torah minayin is a pasuk that says, Anochi ha-Ster astir. Esther, the way I understand this is that Esther sort of emerged. She wasn't, there was no way to know what Esther's position in the story would turn out to be. Like, you're up to chapter 6, chapter 7, and you don't know anything about Esther. How is she going to do it? So that's Anochi Aster Aster. That sometimes salvation comes in unexpected ways. I mean, you don't give up. I think that's what the Jewish people said. Always when I was very young, I heard the debates between Yaakov Herzog and Toynbee, yeah. So Toynbee said, it just can't be. I mean, how could you be so devoted to just being the way you are? And I think he's right. I mean, it's Akasha. He said the Greeks weren't like that, the Egyptians weren't like that, the Romans weren't like, nobody was like that. So the argument to him that the Jews were like that was a difficult argument. Because if no one is like that, then the Jews are not going to be like that either. So this is Anochi Haster Astir. This is Anochi Haster Astir, that we always believe, we have always managed to believe, those of us who have remained within the fold of the Jewish people, that it'll work out. I don't know how it'll work out. But you can imagine the Jews for 2,000 years davening that they want to go back to Eretz Israel, going back to Yerushalayim, they just kept davening. And I think from that, I mean, I can't tell you that I know, but of course, but it seems to me from the stories that I've heard and the way people talk about it, when they davened, they really meant it. They didn't have any doubts that they were on their way to Eretz Yisrael. And even the non-religious Jews, and the Jews turned out to be Jews but not so religious, when they were offered alternatives to Eretz Yisrael, couldn't pick up on it. Didn't make sense to them. They weren't looking for a house. They wanted to go back to Eretz Yisrael. They didn't want to go to Siberia and speak Yiddish, you know, which was an offer. Beribijan, right? Go to Siberia. The Jews go to Siberia. You put up signs in Yiddish like they have today in Williamsburg, Borough Park, you know. You put up signs in Yiddish, and the signs say, we're here. They didn't want to. They were supported. I mean, the Russian government thought this was a great idea. Lo niklat etzel ha-Yudim. It was not absorbed by the Jewish people. And we're talking about people who are not religious Jews, not people who have some kind of mystical outlook on what is going to happen to them. We're talking about people who are, who come, who have Jewish descent, you know, who speak Yiddish, just like in Ukraine, they spoke Ukrainian. I mean, it was not a big deal as they understood it, but they wouldn't go. And those who went couldn't hack it. And the same thing was true with other offers that were made to the Jewish people, whether they were in Africa or an island someplace. It was not the solution that Am Yisrael looked for. So that's Anochi Aster Astir. V'anochi Aster Astir, Mordechai min HaTorah, minayin dechsev mor dror. Mor dror mira dachya. Dachya means pure. Zach, some kind of a pure bosom. So that's what it says in Masechet Chulin. That's what the Gemara says, that Mordechai and Esther and Haman were part of the formation of the creation of the reconformation of Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael, you know, the Maharal says that Am Yisrael were created in the entire book of Bereishis. It means until Yaakov went to Mitzrayim, and until Yosef greeted them in Mitzrayim, you didn't have Am Yisrael. This Gemara, to my mind, implies that until Purim, you didn't have Am Yisrael. Because the ideas that Am Yisrael held fast to in the generations of the diaspora were ideas which in part were learned through Mordechai and Haman and Esther. Now at the same time, I mean, so you see, I mean, Haman, he's there, he's a hero. Haman is a hero, right? He's one of the people who did it. Don't be like Haman. But that's something. Now look at the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nun Zayin Amud Bet. This is also related to, this Gemara is related to Pesach. What do you say? The great grandchildren of Haman HaRasha were teaching, learning Torah in Bnei Brak. You know where Bnei Brak is? You know? Where it says Coca-Cola. That's Bnei Brak. Now in Bnei Brak, there are a lot of people who learn Torah. But I don't think that any of them would claim that they are mi b'nei banav shel Haman HaRasha, but that's what the Gemara says. Then the Gemara says, mi b'nei banav shel Sisra lamdu tinokot b'Yerushalayim. Sisra was the general who fought against Dvorah and Barak ben Avinoam. Mi b'nei banav shel Sancheiriv. Sancheiriv was responsible for the exile of the 10 tribes in 722 BCE. A great guy. B'nei b'nav shel Sancheiriv lamdu Torah b'rabim. Ma'inon, who are these b'nei b'nav who learned Torah b'rabim? Shmaya v'Avtalion. You know Shmaya v'Avtalion? They are the period which we call today the Zugot. Because they appear in Pirkei Avot as couples, two of them. But they're like Tanaim. Like you can divide the Tanaitic period into two. Well, the second part is from zero till the year 200 approximately, when Rabbi Yehudah Nasi did whatever he did with the Mishnah. And then the 200 years before zero, which were the years of the Zugot. And, you know, they're also Tanaim, all of them. But they're not mentioned in the Mishnah very much. I mean, except here in Pirkei Avot. Okay, so it would seem from this Gemara that even though Amalek as the leader, I'm sorry, Haman as the leader of the Amalekites, even though that sort of came to an end, I mean, he died, he was hanging there on this tree, and there were no more Amalekites. Chazal say, no, that's not how the story ended. The story ended by Haman being reabsorbed into the world of not Am Yisrael, but into the world of Torah. The world of Torah, certainly according to Pirkei Avot, is the elitist world of Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael, there's an elite, right? Because the Torah is the spiritual avenue that we have to get closer to God, but it's also the way we direct ourselves in the world in which we have been placed. We, right, are in this world, and the Torah enables us to formulate a purpose. What are we doing here? And so Haman, Mibnei Banav Shel Haman, Lamdu Torah. Of course, Chazal say other things. How could this be? So they say, well, Haman had really a lot of children. He didn't just have the 10 children that appear in the Megillah, and which we try to kind of get through as quickly as we possibly can. But he had other children. Some say 40 children, some say 100 children. I don't know. But they had a lot of children. And since he had a lot of children, the possibility that his great-grandchildren would be in Bnei Brak learning Torah. In fact, this Gemara existed before Bnei Brak. I mean, Bnei Brak existed as a history. But what we call Bnei Brak today, you have all those people walking around, you know, all those women going shopping, and all those men going to Kollel. You know, that Bnei Brak didn't exist. But this is what Chazal say. So I wanted to tell you what the Tiferet Shlomo says. The Tiferet Shlomo is the Radomsker. Radomsky was a Rebbe in a city called Yah.
I want to say that we know that we have.
What do we have?
Descendants of the Nazis learning Torah in Shalayim. So we have numerous journalistic reports from Jews in Jerusalem who have their roots in Nazi Germany. So,
I mean, what does that mean? That they have their roots?
This sounds so far-fetched in a way, but.
No, nothing is far-fetched. It's just unexpected. I mean, there's nothing far-fetched at all in anything. Anything you could imagine could actually happen. But some things are less expected than others. So anyway, this is what the Radomsker said. The Radomsker, you see the third source here? Vayitzei Haman vayomahu sameach v'tov lev. You know that Haman went to party number one with Esther. And Esther said, let's go to party number two. And Haman was ecstatic. Ecstatic. I mean, Mela, he was invited to party number one, but he didn't expect that there would be a follow-up party that he would be invited to. And so he interpreted reality in the way that people might. They'd say, Haman bayomahu sameach v'tov lev. Sameach v'tov lev. Tov lev in Hebrew means like, you're elevated. It's not just that you're happy about something, but that your whole attitude, the whole way of being has changed. That's tov lev. So lichora, geish litbonein b'davar ze, shenichtav al rashak hazeh, b'lashon nichbad samech v'tov lev. He says, how could the Megillah write that Haman was Samech v'tov lev? Samech v'tov lev, that sounds like it's reserved to good people, for people who know the score, for people who are able to make a distinction, or make a distinction between, you know, whatever happened and what didn't happen. Ulama nireka zeh, the second line, nireba zeh, ki ita v'psikta d'Rabbi Kahana, that's a medrash. P'sikta d'Rabbi Kahana is the name of a medrash, which is, of course, a Medrash Agadah, right? There's a limited number of Medrashei Halacha, but an almost unlimited number of Medrashei Agadah. One of the well-known ones is Psikta de Rabbi Kahana, on the Parsha of Zachor. But it is not the Parsha we read this Shabbos, but the Parsha of the war with Amalek. Kiyad al Keiska, Amar Rav Elozer ben Yaakov nishba Kodesh Baruch Hu b'kis'o she'lo mekabel ger mizaro shel Amalek v'chule. You see the pasuk right below, Vayomer ki yad al keiska milchama l'Hashem b'Amalek midor dor. That somehow this pasuk represents that there's a fissure in the world, like a break, There's a break, and that break has something to do with God. And that's why the pasuk says, Ki yad al kes ka. Kes is kisei, missing an aleph. And ka is the name of God missing vav kes. So there's something missing. Milchama l'Hashem b'amalek midor dor. Somehow that this causes, or this has to cause, a war with Amalek midor dor. And Rabbi Lozo ben Yaakov said, Bishbako dishbocho bekis o. This was a kind of a way of making an oath that kings would use, kings in that they knew about, but that God would make an oath, Sheino mekabel ger mizar oshel Amalek. That even if some descendant of Amalek would decide to convert, his conversion would not be counted. Lefika kisheba mevaser etzel David v'hushoel miata v'amar ben ish ger Amaleki anochi lo kiblo David. Now, if you don't remember the story, just look at the source below that. Vayi achrei mot Shaul v'David shav mehakot et ha'amalek v'eshev David b'siklag yamin shanim. So that there was a war with Amalek that was begun by Shaul but was continued by David HaMelech. Vayi b'yom ha'shlishi, I'm reading the psukim, v'inei ishba min ha'machaneh me'im Shaul uv'gadav kru'im v'adamal rosho v'yibolo al David. So this guy looked like a refugee. He had run away from someplace, and he came to see David. David, he said, "I'm a lost Israeli. I was in the battle." Vayomer elav David, "Ma yadavah gedna li vayomer shenasa amin emilchama." So he reports the war went badly. Shaul and Yonatan were both killed. How do you know that they died? That Shaul and Yonatan died? This, of course, was important for David, who was going to become the king. So we know that Shaul was fighting a lost cause. The enemy was overcoming him, and he was on his sword, meaning that the sword had entered his body. He called to me. He, Shaul HaMelech, called to me. Vayomer li mi ata. I said to him, I'm an Amaleki. I mean, the Amalekites lived in the south of Eretz Yisrael, I think, you know, either on the western side of the Jordan, the eastern, both sides. Anyway, they lived there.
Ki achazani hashavatz ki kol od nafshi.
So he asked this guy, who admitted he was an Amaleki, to kill him. This is the story of the death of Shaul HaMelech. And I stood up over him, and I killed him. Ki adati, ki lo yichyech rei naflo. I knew he was going to die anyway. V'akach ha'nezer asher rosho v'atzada. Now imagine this. An Amalekite is crowning David as the king of Israel. How is he doing that? He brings the crown of Shaul HaMelech, right? He brings the crown, and he brings this, some kind of a, not a ring, what do you call this? Something. You know, like a bracelet. Maybe it's not like a bracelet, but they used to wear it on the arm, the upper arms, not jangling around. He says, Aviyem el Adoni heina, v'yichazek David bivgadav, v'yikra'em, v'kol
Gam kol anashim asher ito. So David went into a state of mourning. Shaul was dead. Yonatan was dead. Vayispedu vayivku vayatsumu ad ha'erev al Shaul val Yonatan beno val am Hashem val Beit Yisrael ki naflu b'charev. So they spent the entire army of David HaMelech was distressed about the death of Shaul and Yonatan. Vayomer David el hanar magid lo emi ze ata. Vayomer ben ish ger amaleki anochi. The plot thickens. My father, the Amaleki, was a ger, and as we know today, being a ger is not an easy thing, right? You know, it's like a new kind of game. Oh, you think you're a ger? Today, I read in, and I don't like asides, I mean, I read in some kind of, also some Google story, that the chief rabbi announced that so-and-so, his gerut is no good, because in America they pay a lot of money for gerut. Like if you want a gerut, you pay. So he says he even knows of somebody who paid $1 million to be converted. I said, well, I miss out on all these good opportunities. I mean, $1 million? Of course, I'll convert him right away. I mean, what's the... But in any event, this became an issue recently. It just recently became an issue, and the result of which is that Orthodox rabbis in America, they can't always convert people. You have to be on a list. Everything in Israel is like a secret list. So there's a secret list of rabbis who are allowed to convert people. And if you're not on the list, I mean, you can't do it, and $1 million just disappear. So he said, Ben ish ger amaleki anochi. Vayomer lav David, Ech lo yareita lishloch yadcha, lishachet et Mashiach Hashem. He says, what? How could you have imagined that you had the right to kill Shaul HaMelech? I mean, what's the difference if he asked you to kill him? I mean, who are you? Don't you think that to murder the king of Israel, you have to be somebody of stature? Ve'ikra David le'echad mi'anarim v'yomer gash pega bo v'yakeyu v'yamot. So David calls some guy and says, you see this one? Kill him. V'yomer lav David damcha al roshecha ki picha ana v'cha le'mor anachi motati et Mashiach Hashem. So what do you think? What do you think David HaMelech thought? He thought that being a member of Amalek is a curse. You can't overcome it. You can't. I mean, look at what he did. He fought with the army of Israel. He was devoted to Shaul, and he killed him because he asked him to kill him. And then he came to David HaMelech with the crown and this armband to declare him king of Israel. And what did David HaMelech do? He killed him. What does the Radomska say? He says, Omer Avalos ben Yaakov, Nishma Kodesh Baruch Hu Kisos Shid B'Kabal Ger B'Zaro Shel Amalek, that God has promised not to accept a ger. B'Zaro Shel Amalek, L'Figach Sheba B'Vaser Eitzel David, V'Ushu El Mi'ata, V'amar ben ish ger amaleki anachnu anochi lo kiblo David. David HaMelech did not accept him. He was not part of Am Yisrael. V'nei zehu kama haya plia be'enei divrei ha-medrash hazeh shehu efech ha-gemara. He says, you imagine this medrash says that Amalek is like, you can't cure yourself from being Amalek, you have to get rid of him. And he says, what about the Gemara? The Ita in Gittin, Nun Zayin Amabed, the Gemara that we just learned. V'b'nei banav shel Haman lamdu Torah b'b'nei Brak. So the Radomsker
doesn't just say it's a wonder that B'nai Banav Shel Haman Limdu Torah B'nai Brak. But he said it's a kasha. It is a contradiction. David HaMelech, if David HaMelech would have known that the great-great-great-grandchildren of this fellow would be learning Torah in B'nai Brak, he wouldn't have killed him. It would be such a suffix. The only way to explain David HaMelech is that David HaMelech was certain that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would not allow Geirim, whose origin was Amalek, he wouldn't allow them into Klal Yisrael. So he killed him. Well, how did these guys, these B'nai Haman, get to B'nai Brak to learn Torah and to teach Torah? I mean, that's the question that the Tiferes Shlomo asks, the Radomsker. What's the question? That's the question. Okay. Achein hanau, nearly, al pi ma sheyadanu mimalat ha-tzadikim. So here the Radomsker says, everybody knows what I'm about to tell you about tzadikim. Ki gadol ha-ne'ne mishulchan gavoa, asher talmidei chachamim mesubim ba, lavi et ha-adam lidei tara u-kudusha. He says, gadol, you know, Hasidim have this thing about eating. You ever notice that? They're always at a table, and they're always eating. They're always eating. And so he tells you why they're always eating. He says, Mashi Adanui Malata Tzadikim, we know something about the righteous ones. Ki gadol ha-ne'ne mishulchan gavoa, greater is the one who has pleasure. Mishulchan gavoa, shulchan gavoa is the mizbeach. The food that's prepared on the mizbeach, Asher Talmidei Chachamim Mesubim Ba, when other Talmidei Chachamim are sitting around the table, Lavi Et Adam Lidei Tahara Ukidusha. That it's not enough to be at the table. It's not enough to bring the Korban, to sacrifice. But what you need is the camaraderie of Talmidei Chachamim, of special people to bring you to that level of Tara and Kedusha. Lachain, kasher zimna Esther et Haman al mishteh azeh, al mishteh zeh pa'amayim, v'aya Haman gam ken shoeif ma'at michiyut ha-kedusha mishteh asudot halalu. So the Verdovska, Hashem tzachnet, he's not embarrassed. He said Esther was like a Hasidish Rebbe. And if Esther made a meal, and they all ate together with Esther, they were in heaven. They were all in heaven. That's Esther min ha-Torah min ayin. That even in Haster Aster, even when you don't see the presence of God, God is there. That was Esther. So when she organized the meal, she was the Rebbe. And the meal was not Stama meal. It wasn't like you would imagine, but it was rather a meal that brought you closer to Kedusha and Tahara, and he was there. He was there by Yag Haman, next to the last line. God came show Eif Ma'at Mechiyut HaKedusha Mishteh Sudot. You imagine that Haman ate two meals with Esther, and Esther, eating a meal with Esther, was experientially different. Mishteh Sudot Halalu V'zeh She'amar Sameach V'tov Lev. What was the Radomska's kasha at the beginning? What did he say? Vayitzei Ha'aman V'yomahu Sameach V'tov Lev. That he was happy, but he wasn't just happy, like he won the that Ariella called him from the Vala Pius. It wasn't that kind of happy. It was a different kind of happy. He was Tuv Lev. Tuv Lev. She didn't call you, right? She didn't call you. All right, there's a fight, but she didn't call either. I only know about it because I heard it on the radio. But, you know, I'm waiting for the call. I mean, on the other hand, I think it's the amounts are too small. Sameach v'tuv levav. So sameach means he's happy. Yes, there's a mitzvah you have a tuv levav. Tuv Levav is a change in your spiritual makeup. It's like you're a different person. So the Radomska said, why does it say, Mibnei Banav Shel Haman Lamdu Torah Bnei Brak? It could just as well say in the Gemara, Mibnei Banav Shel Amalek Lamdu Bnei. That would be a really startling thing, right? Wouldn't that be amazing? Mibnei Banav Shel Amalek are learning Torah Bnei Brak? The answer is that Amalek was Amalek. They couldn't produce Torah learners. But Haman, because he ate the meal with Esther Hamalka, who was Haster Aster, who represented that even when you don't know something is going on, something is going on. It was inconceivable that he, Haman, would not be affected by what was going on at the meal. And so he finishes. Zeshama sameach v'tuv levav. Lachein yatzu mimenu. But not from Amalek. From Haman. Hatzadikim alolu shalomdu Torah b'bnei Brak. So that when you say Esther min haTorah minayim, it doesn't just mean that Am Yisrael had to understand that even when God is not acting in an obvious way, there's no reason to think that God is not acting. Right? That's what Am Yisrael had to learn. But that the Haster Aster, this understanding of things came about because Esther was able to produce something different in the world, something that nobody else ever knew about. And that was that a su'uda itself could be a religious moment, that the spirituality, this is what Hasidus, you know, they always have, if you learn the Tanya, you see that the Bala Tanya has this problem with how come we are the way we are. Like, there's a lot of things about us that are like, I don't want to say Nefesh Bahamas, because he says it many times, but I mean, we are like, in many ways, we're like animals. Right? We eat, we sleep, we reproduce, we have desires, and if you match up like a living person to a porpoise, we don't come about so much better. You know, porpoises are friendly, they're happy, they eat, they sleep, they do, you know. So that somehow the Hasidim decided, or they understood after, I mean, it took a long time, that just as the Mizbeach, the Korban, must produce a different kind of eating. It's not like just eating a hamburger, but somehow we can strive to produce that result through the eating that we do. And to some extent, it's done through brachot, I think. Right? You kind of say, God did this. That you try to involve God in what it is that you are doing. But in the Hasidut, the idea of having a meal together, of sharing the food with the Rebbe, is an idea that has certainly a very powerful place in the way they do it. And so Haman was influenced by the su'uda that he ate with Esther, who understood something about Haster Astir, and therefore both of them were elevated by this understanding. And even though Haman himself was killed, still we know that Mibnei Banav Shel Haman was sitting and learning Torah in Bnei Brak. So it's not so clear, that these people, that as I said at the beginning, that these characters are all one-sided, and they are actually always kind of influencing each other. And so that even though Esther, by one reading, you know, Esther and Haman are at odds with each other, and there's no way for them to make any peace, there is nevertheless this Gemara in Gittin that seems to indicate something different. And so Haman, even though he was certainly the father of anti-Semitism in some way, nevertheless is perceived as having been influenced by those who he had been dueling with Esther and Achashverosh, etc. And therefore, we can say about them that B'nai Banav Shel Haman Lamdu Torah B'B'nai Brak. Have a happy Purim. And Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you. This Shabbos is a Parashat Zohar. It's good that in our time, you know, women also go to hear Parashat Zohar. I mean, it's not a bad thing to do. Not a bad thing to do. There's a machlokes achronim about whether women are chayavot to hear Parashat Zohar or not. But mayesh, sometimes you go for the optimal position. Good Shabbos, good Shabbos. Marif, you're diving already? Took us so long to daven mincha. What?
Shaul's wife took him at Munah because they couldn't take his evidence of the death of Shaul.
Yeah, but they knew that he died. He wasn't
They still needed some specific